Welcome to our AJAG PD Pod, the place for discussion, debate, and learning about all things accounting. Our hosts, Ivan Tabak, Jonathan Tucker, are CPAs that have been in practice for more than 3 decades. Together, they bring varying experience and viewpoints to the table, not to mention a little humor, too. Join us as we talk through current issues and hot topics, tap into expert guest insights, and enjoy the odd walk down AJAG memory lane. Before we begin today's podcast, please note, although the educational material within the podcast has been carefully prepared, none of the persons involved in the preparation of the material accepts any legal responsibility for its contents or for any consequences arising from its use. As well, the podcast material and the references contained therein may reflect laws and practices that are subject to change. Advice regarding a particular fact or situation should always be reviewed by a qualified professional. This podcast is produced and distributed by AJAG Professional Development. For more information about AJAG or any of its offerings, please visit ajag.ca.
Hello, and thank you for joining us today for AJAG PD Pod episode number 8. Today, my guest is Andrew Feldstein from Feldstein Family Law Group.
Thank you for having me, Ivan.
Thank you. So, Andrew, why don't you just tell us a little bit about yourself and your practice, and then we can get into our topic of the day.
As you know, Ivan, we're a family law practice, so we practice exclusively in the area of family law, and that means we deal with divorces, we deal with the breakups from common law cases, we deal with all sorts of complex financial issues and parenting issues as well.
Okay. That includes preparation of all agreements, prenups, post...
Well, the only thing we don't do is prenups.
Okay.
But we do all other areas of family law. If anyone is interested, our website is separation.ca. There's a plethora of information available for your viewers on family law. And we have four offices throughout the GTA, being in Markham, Vaughan, Mississauga, and Oakville.
Okay. And how long have you been in practicing in this area?
For 30 years now.
30 years. Okay. So I presume you know what you're doing and are qualified to talk about our topic of the day.
I certainly think so.
All right. So the main reason we set this up, and this was kind of a last minute decision to have you on and do this, is because of the upcoming changes to the taxation of capital gains. Now, everybody's heard of what's been going on, and there's been lots of articles written and videos made about this, and we've offered a course already about the implications of capital gains. And even though a lot of the issues are still unknown, the legislation hasn't been released yet, but people still need to do some planning in anticipation of what's coming. And one of the issues that I had never heard anybody talk about is one that you had mentioned to me, is what the implications of triggering capital gains early to take advantage of the current lower inclusion rates, what that would, the implications of that on the calculation of child support payments for anybody who's currently in the process of negotiating a separation agreement, and the child support, and possibly also the spousal support. So why don't you talk a little bit about that and what people in those situations need to understand?
Well, I'm going to start with, it's not just people who are negotiating a separation agreement, because most agreements will have a provision that requires an annual review of child support, which means each year you're giving your tax return to your former spouse, your corporate financial statements, your corporate tax returns. So if you're not doing it, quite frankly, you're legally obligated to do it if you're required to pay child support. Now, for the exercise today, I solely focused on child support because the issues are somewhat different for child support and spousal support. What I mean by that is child support starts from the premise of a buck is a buck is a buck almost all the time. So you can try and have some arguments around it. I don't necessarily think that they'll be successful. Whereas for spousal support, you may have a better argument. So I didn't want to include that in the analysis, because I think, as your listeners will see from our illustration, the one example I took, triggering the capital gain can have absolutely horrendous consequences for a support payor, where the tax savings are really a small fraction of what additional child support you may be obligated to pay. And someone may say, well, it's child support. I'm going to pay it no matter what. Well, that's not really correct, because if your children are older and you don't trigger the capital gain till after your child support is over, you may never be paying this child support to your former spouse. There may be issues for spousal support, and if there's time, we can have a brief chat about that. But from a child support perspective, you may be creating significant costs, and I'd like to walk you through an example.
Sure.
I did two scenarios with respect to the example of what happens of a capital gain. Now, obviously, you can play around with many scenarios, and it may generate different numbers, but I thought this was an easy illustration. I take the support payor who earns $150,000 of income, and that would generate a table child support of $2,077 a month, or $24,924 of child support a year. In the same scenario, I said, let's take that same support payor, and I'm not even factoring in the $250,000 of the free capital gain you get under the proposed rules, because I didn't even want to factor that in.
Right.
I wanted to keep it really simple, and I said, let's call it a capital gain of $750,000. Why that number? I just picked it for illustration purposes. And what a lot of people don't appreciate is, because of the inclusion rate is currently 50%, the courts have the discretion to do a gross up on a capital gain. And what they're really trying to say is, how much employment income would it take someone to generate that additional tax-free portion if they went to work every day?
Mm-hmm.
So when we look at child support, we wouldn't be looking at it on the taxable capital gain. We wouldn't be looking at it most of the time on the actual capital gain, but we would actually be looking at it for what it would be with the gross up. And that person there who has employment income of $150,000 and a capital gain of $750,000, his income is actually, with the gross up, going to be over $1.3 million.
Wow.
So that gross up is really powerful. And in the illustration, that would generate child support of $16,261 a month, or $195,132 for the year. So what does this mean to the support payer? The support payer says, I'm going to take an extra $750,000 capital gain because I want it at the better inclusion rate. And they're going to find out, after they decided to trigger this and feel good that they made a smart tax decision, that they're actually going to owe their former spouse another $170,000 of child support. Some people may say, it's not fair. There's a threshold over $150,000. The courts will say, an income of $1.3 million, you're paying full table child support. So that person is now going to have $170,000 of additional child support for 1 year. Now, let's talk about what would be, and this again is not factoring the $250,000 portion that's free, but I just did a simple calculation to say, if the inclusion rate had an extra 17% attributed to it at a 53.5% tax rate, so it's not perfect because the $150,000 isn't quite there.
Right.
But in any event, I said the taxes under the new rules would be $268,000 and change. Tax at the current rate would be about $200,000, so the difference is about $68,000. So in the best case scenario, you're saving $68,000, probably less, because under the new rules you have that $250,000.
Right.
But even in this case, you're going to pay, because you trigger that capital gain, an extra $100,000 of child support. You put that $250,000 free capital gain in, and maybe about $130,000 of additional child support that you're going to pay. So you look at it and you say, oh my God, no, like you said before, nobody's talking about this. So you're going to phone your tax advisor. You're going to have a discussion with your tax advisor. They're not even going to be thinking about this. But us divorce lawyers, we think about these kinds of issues.
Right.
And to me, it's becomes really obvious that probably in most scenarios, if you're a support payor, whether you're negotiating or you're paying and you have your annual disclosure and you're paying for 12 months a year, the answer is pretty simple. don't trigger the capital gain for taxes. If you're triggering it because there's a business reason behind it and that's what you think is the best move to do, okay, and then you know you're going to pay some support on it.
Right. And this issue, as you had mentioned before, is not strictly related to somebody who's currently in the process of negotiating a deal. It's for anybody who's already in the in an agreement who is paying child support. So it's not even strictly an issue of dealing with these new rules. It's even if these new rules weren't coming into place, that's what triggered our discussion. But even if that wasn't the case, triggering a large capital gain at any point while you are in the process of paying the support would create a possible issue, at least for increased child support going forward.
Absolutely, yeah. It does. So that's why I say you got to make your decision on appreciating the business model of it. Because in the scenario we just gave there, that person is going to pay the tax on $375 of income under the current rules. Let's call that about $187.5, I guess, would be the taxes they're going to pay. They're going to pay $170,000 of additional child support. So now what they're putting in their pocket after tax on that $750 cap gain is more around $400,000. And that's if you don't get to the issue of spousal support, because that could be on top of it. And there's lots of different rules that go with spousal support. So I really wanted to keep it simple and say, if you're a child support payor, think twice about whether you want to trigger this gain.
Right. No, absolutely. Now,
I think we wanted to discuss about spousal support. What would happen? And spousal support has a different genesis to it, because spousal support is viewed slightly different than child support. What do I mean by that? Child support in the eyes of the court is considered the right of the child. Now, every support payer I've ever spoken to says, I really don't see the difference. If I give my former spouse $5,000 of child support and $5,000 of spousal support, it's not like a certain amount goes to the children, a certain amount goes to her. It's a pool of money that they get. And they're going to decide how they want to spend that pool of money. The courts don't agree with that view. They view the child support as the right of the child, different than spousal support. Where does that take you and what's the significance of that? There's a concept of double dipping, and I'll explain to you what that means. So let's say I have a cottage on the date of separation, and let's say I separated January 1, 2022. And on that day, I bought out my ex-wife of the cottage. Let's say that cottage is worth $2 million on the date of separation. Yeah. And my cost base was $1.25 million. So I have this $750,000 unrealized capital gain that flowed into my equalization calculation. I bought my former spouse out of that. We considered the taxes and the buyout. Now it's mine. Now, when I go to sell it and realize on that capital gain, I can say for the purposes of spousal support, that would be double dipping. My ex already shared in that gain. She already got her share, so I wouldn't have to pay any spousal support on that $750,000 gain. If that has gone up another $500,000, let's say to $2.5 million, then there's going to be an argument about whether that additional $500,000 should be income for spousal support or not. The arguments would be it's a non-reoccurring income, it's a one-time event, and the court may be sympathetic to that. So you may or may not be able to protect all of it. You certainly can protect some of it from double dipping.
But for child support purposes,
those are probably going to be losing arguments.
Right.
Probably. There's always some cases that may creep in. But generally speaking, you're probably going to lose. So there's this matrix of being cognizant of what's there for spousal support. So if you're that person who the entire capital gain or close to the entire capital gain was earned during the course of the marriage and you want to trigger it for this inclusion rate, you can be saying to yourself, geez, I have the $750,000 I've already bought myself of the capital gain. I'm better off to wait for my kids to stop being children that I have to pay child support before I trigger this game.
Right.
Because there's 170,000 reasons right there why you'd be better off to wait.
Right.
Now, there are some cases where that may not apply and you may get dinged with spousal support too, because, you know, in a short discussion like we're having today, you're not going to be able to cover every scenario. But it's the kind of thing that if you're actually thinking about this, it's ironic as I say it, I would be consulting with the family law lawyer to think about it, but I can tell you, I haven't had one phone call from someone saying, I'm thinking about triggering a capital gain. How will that affect my child and or spousal support? So people aren't turning their mind to it.
Right. Absolutely. Like we said, is until you raised this issue with me the other day when we were speaking, I had never considered this, and I have not heard this mentioned anywhere in anything I've read on online. So I think anybody watching who's either going through in this scenario themselves or has clients that are dealing with this, absolutely something that has to be considered in the next 3 weeks.
It's the kind of thing for professionals, it's stressful when they put a tight timeline on
for
it
sure.
For you in that respect. But I think in a lot of cases, when you crunch the numbers, if you're paying child support, it's problematic. I guess the equivalent part of the question would be where I say, wait till there's no more child support. There's a problem in that advice too. And that is, if the child support drops off the table in the same scenario I said to you, there was an unrealized gain, mm-hmm. you rolled over the cost base and you equalized, we'll take the scenario where the gain is all post-separation. There's no double dipping argument. Your only argument is it's a one-time non-reoccurring, which may or may not be successful. So you may find yourself saying, aha, I don't have to pay it as child support, but there's a risk that a court could say that's income for spousal support.
Right.
So there's a double-edged sword. Now, here's where some of the rules get fascinating. When you resolve a case, you have an obligation while there's child support to report your income to the other side. So every year you have the annual disclosure, whether it's in the agreement or not. The Supreme Court of Canada said support payors have that obligation. So as an example, every year I have the great pleasure of sending my former spouse all of my financial disclosure. But the interesting aspect of it is in a few years when my child support comes to an end, because it's not that much longer for me, when my table child support comes to an end, my obligation to provide that information ceases. So when that happens, if you have an ongoing support obligation, there are certain gains that your former spouse will have no idea that you triggered or didn't trigger. So, for example, if we take selling the cottage, your former spouse is probably going to know you sold the cottage.
Right.
But if you're talking about I have a certain stock and I picked a real winner, if she doesn't ask for my tax returns, then she's never going to know when it's only spousal support that's in play, because the difference between child support and spousal support as well, and this is a significant difference, child support has an annual review provision where there's mandatory disclosure. Mm-hmm. Spousal support doesn't. Spousal support is subject to change when there's a material change in circumstance. And most, but not all agreements don't have an obligation for disclosure for the purposes of spousal support. And then the support payer would say to me, well, Andrew, how do I know if there's a material change? You got to ask. You got to say, I think there's been this. So you take the scenario, somebody sold the cottage. You may then say, geez, you now had this big gain. I want support on that. Now your cottage is, you sold it and it's been converted to investments. Now you should have investment income. So I want some support on that. And there's a whole plethora of arguments about post-separation increases in income and whether they get included or don't get included. But suffice it to say, there's a risk there.
Right.
But if you sell stock and your lifestyle doesn't change, so what I guess what I'm saying is, if you bought the right stock and you had the $1 million gain, don't brag. Don't go get an expensive car.
Right.
Enjoy life, but don't enjoy it so much that you're raising questions.
Right. Got it. So let me ask you, so for someone who has already signed an agreement that is in the process of making payments, if gains are triggered now, there's really nothing they can do about it. It'll get disclosed and the calculations would likely be adjusted. But for somebody who's currently negotiating an agreement, What would you suggest they consider, or their lawyers consider, putting in there to possibly mitigate this type of thing? Maybe not for the child support, but possibly for the spousal support. Their caps.
You can try to negotiate it, but I look at the calendar. We're sitting here on June 5th. So that's going to make it difficult to have a piecemeal portion of the deal negotiated on one item so you can trigger the capital gain.
Right.
I guess I almost look at it to say, even if you're a regular support payor, I know we were having this chat before we started, the commercial real estate's gone through the roof. So picture the owner of some commercial real estate wants to sell a building, and they know they have an unrealized gain of $10 million. Huge gain. And if you just look at what the numbers did on support there, mm-hmm. it could be a very large support payment. Now, at $10 million, you may be getting to a better number where the court may not just rigidly apply the guidelines. So there's maybe some room there. But what you could do in that scenario is approach your ex and their lawyer and say, listen, I'm thinking of triggering a gain. I have a whole whack of arguments as to why all the child support shouldn't be paid. We now have, 19, 20 days left. Let's negotiate what my support payment will be on that gain in advance. Because otherwise, I'm not going to sell it. I'm not going to trigger it. And you may or may not see anything.
Right.
So that's something I would do. But if you're doing that, you got to do it with lawyers. You got to do it with proper financial disclosure. Because if you don't do it, the agreement is ripe for problems. And because there's only about 19 days, every day that goes by makes it that much harder to have an agreement that's negotiated, as the Supreme Court of Canada would say, in a spousal support case, in an unimpeachable fashion.
Right. Now, if we put aside the change in the capital gain inclusion rate, if we put that issue aside, triggering a gain later in the year or next year would still have the same implication.
It always does, except for one exception to the rule.
Okay.
And that is a capital loss in the same calendar year. And this usually shocks accountants when I say it to them, because most people think, well, if I have a capital loss from 2 years ago, I can bring it forward to this year. And for tax purposes, that would be correct.
Not for support purposes.
But not for support purposes. The capital loss has to be in the same year as the capital gain. So the other way of dealing with this scenario of the $750,000 capital gain would be looking at your portfolio and saying, do I have any really big losers that I should sell?
Right.
That would help.
Right. And as you said, that's good for support purposes, but if somebody did want to try and take advantage of the lower inclusion rate before June 25th, triggering capital losses at the same time of triggering the capital gains might not be so good. But then again, we're talking calendar year for the support calculation. So you could still have your tax planning in terms of triggering the loss post June 25th, where you would be able to apply that against capital gains at the higher inclusion rate. And then you could choose to use the loss against the lower inclusion rate or not for tax purposes.
It gets complicated.
It does.
And I often say to clients that if you're going to trigger any gains, or you have investment advisors that have triggered gains, you should be looking and reviewing your portfolio in December of each year to see, do I want to trigger any offsetting losses that year? Because once you miss that year, you're out of luck for child support purposes.
Right.
Now, unfortunately, I like to say that, but then most years I forget to do it with my investment advisor.
Right. Yeah. And then I think that is a general rule, thinking that your taxable income is what drives the support calculation is not obviously correct. It's the nature of the income itself that has to be looked at. And if there are capital gains, it's not taxable income. And as you said, if you apply losses carried forward, which drives down your current year taxable income, that will not have an impact. Or a positive impact on the... It'll have no impact. Right. So, again, it's always the connection between income tax planning and family law support payment planning.
They don't always go
hand in
hand.
It doesn't mesh, and it's not widely considered, at least among individuals who don't have a more sophisticated situation, who are dealing with advisors all the time.
Well, I remember when I was a young lawyer, I did some family law and I did corporate commercial, and I had a client come to me with a reorganization, and as part of the reorganization, he made his spouse a shareholder, not telling me that their marriage was on the rocks, and 3 months later calling me about separating. And he just made his wife a shareholder in his business. And most of the time I will say that's a bad thing, because when you separate, you don't want, it's bad enough you got to pay support, but you don't necessarily want your former spouse sharing in the potential gains of the business and improvement of the business post-separation because they're getting the support. So that typically is a negative thing, except when you're in a business where you're not necessarily behaving ethically and you're doing a lot of cash business, it's nice to have your former spouse as a director, because then they can't threaten to report you to CRA because they're going down with the ship too.
Right.
So in those cases, it may be a good thing.
Right. But again, there's so many issues and planning things that accountants do are more often than not done without consideration of the family law implications. And I know when I'm setting up a new corporation or working on a structure, I almost always remember to have that discussion with, we'll call it the principal shareholder, the one who will be the active person in the business, and say, you know, you've got to consider what happens down the road. And more, 99% of the time, it's, yeah, don't worry about it. Everything's fine. I want it this way. And there have been a couple of cases in my client base where that has come back to bite them.
It's an interesting point you raise, because historically, the reason you would make your spouse a shareholder in your business is for the capital gains, lifetime capital gains exemption, right, so that you get two instead of one. So as long as that exemption is there, the motivation is there. But as they've clawed back here, and I know they're clawing back on minimum tax.
Yep.
So the more and more they claw back on these things, is that going to change, move the needle in that discussion to say the gain that you're getting by making your spouse is becoming smaller and smaller by making them a shareholder, that it may not be as worthwhile as it once was? And the other thing I often say is, how often do you really see small businesses being sold at a premium in a share sale? It really isn't that often.
So again, you're right. Looking at that structure, often it's set up for consulting businesses and which can't be sold, so there'd be no capital gain. But possibly you could get some income splitting, even avoiding the tax on split income once the individuals are over 65. And they can do that. So there can still be some tax benefits of having a spouse as the shareholder, even if it's not a saleable business. But
is that gain worth the risk when you're a consultant and you've built up some equity in the business and there's money in the company, mm-hmm, and now your former spouse is saying, "Hey, I'm your partner. I'm your partner in the contracts you have."
Right.
There's an extra layer of aggravation that I'm going to have to deal with, which means you're going to pay for, that you don't want.
Right.
And I also think of it for my own separation. I have some real estate that I operate out of, and I just picture, had I made my former spouse a shareholder of my real estate company, would I have liked her to have set up an office in my office and said, "Well, I'm your landlord"? Because that could happen.
Right.
You know, if you think about what you're taught from a tax planning perspective and creditor proofing perspective, you would be told, well, if you have real estate, it should be in a separate company, and that company should be owned by the non-operating spouse.
Right.
Isn't that what we would say?
Typically, yeah.
Yeah. But then you have that non-operating spouse say, well, I'm your landlord now.
Right. That's why you need a shareholder agreement.
You do, but then you go. But is a shareholder agreement a domestic contract when it's between spouses? And was there proper financial disclosure? Was there proper family law, independent legal advice? And do you want to go down the road of now saying, yeah, that is a marriage contract, or is or something you think you're doing a good turn by your spouse really worth it?
Right. You think that you know, when somebody's incorporating a business, these should be questions on a questionnaire as part of the incorporation. Have you considered this? Have you considered that?
But it's not.
It's not.
It's not, and it won't be.
And that's what keeps us in business, too.
That's right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. Well, this has been a great discussion. Thank you for coming in and bringing this to my attention and everyone's attention. It's going to be an interesting couple of weeks between now and the time the actual legislation is released, and we can see if anything that they finally put out will change any of the potential issues we're talking about, and that'll get the accountants at least scrambling to get some planning into place by the 25th. So, Andrew, thanks again for being here. And thanks again for watching, and we'll see you the next time.
Thank you for having me.
Bye.